Greetings and welcome all to our teleclass on preventing surgical wound infections, or as our speaker has subtitled it, a funny thing happens on the way to the OR. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome all of you to this teleclass. A special welcome to you if this is your first teleclass experience. You have picked a good one. I count our faculty today as a very, very good friend. Dr. Dick Zoutman is a professor of pathology and molecular medicine at Queen's University in Kingston. He is chief of the Department of Medical Microbiology at Kingston General Hospital, as well as the medical director of infection control services there. Dr. Zoutman is the physician director for Chica Canada and holds too many other jobs to mention, so I'll stop mentioning them now. The Dick Zoutman that I know is a humanitarian. He's a creator of outstanding educational materials. He's a very popular speaker worldwide and a tireless researcher. One of his many research projects in recent years was a very large study on surgical site infections, and he'll touch on that during his presentation today. He is the perfect person to give this topic, and I am really honored to have him along. To give the teleclass Preventing Surgical Wound Infections, it is my pleasure to introduce my distinguished friend, Dr. Dick Zoutman. Dick.
Thank you, Paul, for much undeserved accolades. I'm pleased to be able to participate in a teleclass from Kingston, Ontario, in Canada, where it's cloudy and snowing lightly. I am at Queen's University, the oldest degree-granting institution in Canada. And it's a real pleasure to know that there are that many people around the world listening and that we can have an engaging discussion around preventing surgical wound infections. Although the title is drawn from the play A Funny Thing Happens on the Way to the Forum, surgical wound infections are anything but funny. And I'd like to spend a minute telling you about the significance that they do have both for our patients who we serve and also for institutions and the healthcare system as a whole. When we, into slide number two, look at the practical meaning of quality, anyone would say that if they got 80% on a test, they did pretty good. However, if you looked at that from the point of view of a large production system, which is what a surgical operating room is, and compared it to that of a bank, good would mean 36 million checks drawn on the wrong account every day. We wouldn't call that good. If we thought about 99% being very good, perhaps, that would still mean that we would have unsafe drinking water 15 minutes out of each day or no electricity for almost 7 hours each month, something none of us are accustomed to in the wealthier nations of the world. And if we push that up to, say, 99.9% is what we call good, that still means we would lose, in North America, 16 to 20,000 articles of mail every hour, and there might be two unsafe landings per day at major airports in North America. So when we talk about good and about preventing, even though we say we have only a 1% infection rate, we have to focus in on that 1% because we do so many surgeries and so many high-volume cases around the world that 1% or 2% can become highly significant. When we look at the literature on medical mishaps, surgical wound infections figure very prominently. The classic study by Brennan and Lee, published in the New England Journal in 91, over a decade ago, is still one of the standard papers in this subject, and it clearly indicates that drug-related problems are common, but it is actually a surgical wound infection. Although numerically it comes in second as a medical mishap, it has been associated with the greatest morbidity, cost, and mortality compared to drug-related incidents overall. And so we must not lose sight of the fact that surgical infections are the most important numerically and qualitatively nosocomial infections we're going to see. I'm looking at slide four now, the burden of nosocomial infections, and this is back-of-the-envelope calculations for Canada. And if you looked at the rate you would expect per 100 admission of surgical wound pneumonia, bacteremia, urinary tract, and other sorted nosocomial infections, I draw your attention to the third column down, 219,834, almost a quarter million cases of nosocomial infection year in, year out in Canada, with a significant mortality that's estimated to be between 8,000 and 12,000 people dying in Canada, And in the U.S., the CDC quotes a number approximately 10 times as large, which is exactly in proportion to the U.S.'s population compared to Canada. So independently, Canada and the U.S. have come up with the same morbidity figures for nosocomial infections. And I'd also point out that surgical wound infections are the ones associated with the greatest contribution to excessive length of stay among all the other infections. It competes with pneumonia for cost and attributable length of stay. So it is really one of the most important infections. If we can reduce it even by a fraction, we make significant headway. On slide number 5, I'd like to just remind you of the history, because really when you think of the history of infection control and microbiology, a lot of it relates to the history of surgical infections. Surgery in the 1800s consisted of chopping off your leg, done without an anesthetic and under the most aseptic conditions imaginable. In 1843, Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote a paper about the impact that dirty hands might be having on infections in hospitals. And it was really Ignaz Semmelweis in 1861 who, when they were seeing necrotizing fasciitis of the pelvic organs of females postpartum, indicated that everyone should be washing their hands with chlorinated lime, which he did. To his credit, unfortunately, it also impaired his career advancement. Louis Pasteur in 1863 really nailed it down when he showed us what germs were, and Joseph Lister, who sprayed carbolic acid over the surgical field to prevent infections. This was a highly unpopular technique, as you can imagine, having the basically what amounts to household bleach being sprayed in the surgical field. And before they performed surgery, they used to say a prayer, and in the days of Joseph Lister, they used to say before surgery, "Let us spray," before they began. Fortunately, we've moved well beyond that. However, these were the people who were seminal in creating our understanding of the importance of asepsis in surgery. On slide 6, I give you some of our information out of the Kingston General Hospital, a tertiary academic health science center, where we attempted to look at the relationship between surgical wound infections and the extra length of stay. LOS is just code for length of stay. In hospitals in North America, like around the world, it is length of stay that drives the costs. A day in our hospital will cost you $2,000 Canadian. The food isn't all that good, and there's not a lot of privacy. Not the best hotel you could be in. That's true for almost all hospitals. But when you consider the gross and attributable wound infection-related length of stay, by gross length of stay, I looked at the number of patients through chart review, the effect that their infection had on their overall length of stay, measured as a mean of 13.6 or a median of 7 extra days. We then reviewed the charts using an attribution algorithm to determine, well, how much of that length of stay was indeed related to the wound infection itself. And indeed, you do lose some of the days of stay, but using a very strict algorithm, you still are left with at least 10, on average, extra attributable length of days of stay that you can say is directly because of the infection. The bottom line, have a wound infection, you bought yourself 10 extra days in hospital at so many thousands of dollars a day. Now, turning to slide number 7 for a minute, you'll see in this pie diagram, we then broke down the attributable costs related to SSI, or surgical site infection costs. And you'll see in the red to your right, if you've got it in color, that nursing costs constitute half of the attributable cost of a surgical wound infection. This is entirely explainable by the need for nursing care in the hospital. The next was the actual hotel cost. That's the cost of running the hospital attributable to the patient, 14%. And then tied are the pharmacy drug costs and the laboratory costs for doing the cultures and giving the antibiotics, and then a smattering of other services relating to the cost. So it's widely distributed across the hospital, but heavily on the nursing side of the cost equation for surgical site infections. When we ask ourselves what are the risk factors that we could intervene, perhaps, to prevent infections, we find that in the literature there's many, many risk factors that have been described. Age. Very young neonates or the very elderly are at increased risk of infection. Your nutritional status is well known to surgeons, that persons who have a great nutritional deficit from chronic disease will not heal well, and they often will bring people into hospital to fatten them up, so to speak, before surgery and certainly after surgery as well. Being a diabetic impairs wound healing, it impairs defenses against infection and vascular supply. Smoking likewise, and similarly for steroids. your preoperative length of stay is a proxy for how sick you are, as also a proxy for the increased risk of acquiring a nosocomial pathogen, which will then come back to get you when you finally get to the operating room. Colonization with Staphylococcus aureus has been known, and likewise colonization with methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, MRSA, are known to be a risk factor for a surgical wound infections. Unfortunately, we do not have the evidence to show that eradicating Staph aureus colonization will actually reduce surgical wound infections, which is a bit disappointing. Perioperative transfusions increase your risk of infection, and having a remote infection distant to the surgical site being operated on is a problem. It's not uncommon for a cardiac surgeon to look at a patient's feet to make sure there's no diabetic foot infections or an IV site infection and then cancel the cardiac surgery because of that small distant infection that could wreak havoc with the patient postoperatively. Turning now to slide number 9, we look at the other operative characteristics that have been linked to infection rates. The presence or absence of preoperative antiseptic showers comes up frequently. It's not uncommon to have hospitals give patients various antiseptic soaps such as chlorhexidine and a sponge and say, use this for 3 or 4 days before your surgery and make sure you scrub the area where we're going to cut you open. There is no hard evidence that this is indeed beneficial, but it is a common practice. Hair removal is vitally important. I don't need to go into much detail. It's well known that preoperative hair removal is by itself a risk factor. Preoperative shaving the day of surgery certainly traumatizes the skin, is well known to be a risk factor. Clipping is better. Not removing the hair at all is best. Patient skin prep in the operating room is very important. I'm not going to go into all of the details, but we do know that chlorhexidine has a long residual effect on the skin and certainly is associated with very low risk of, or improving the risk of infection, and a combination of chlorhexidine with alcohol is highly recommended now. Likewise, the preoperative hand and arm antisepsis of the surgical team, either with a chlorhexidine or triclosan-containing compound, or perhaps with alcohol alone now, have become the standard. Having patients in the operating room who are themselves infected would mean they shouldn't be there at all. However, colonized operating room staff with either group A streptococcus or staphylococcus aureus are very difficult to detect, as it is not routine in most hospitals to be routinely screening our surgical staff in this way. However, if upon looking back one finds an outbreak and is able to attribute it to a group of cases in the operating room, one has to consider the operating room staff as potentially being the source. I will spend some time talking about antimicrobial prophylaxis because it disturbs me that this is one of the simplest interventions and yet is an intervention that hasn't been consistently quality assured in our operating rooms, and more to come on that point in a moment. On slide number 10, we talk about some more of these SSI risk factors, operative characteristics. The ventilation of operating rooms is something that's well described in the literature and in standards that exist internationally. I'm not going to go into all of the characteristics. You need the appropriate number of air exchanges. You need to have the appropriate humidity and filtering of your operating room to a high efficiency filter, which would be the standard these days. Most hospitals meet that standard, but some may not. Especially older hospitals may have trouble HEPA filtering their air because their ventilation system can't manage it. The cleaning of the environment in the OR is basic, and we're not going to go there today in any detail, and microbial sampling of the operating room should only be undertaken, in my view, very carefully if you know you have a problem that demands it. Sterilization of equipment is a very detailed subject unto itself. We won't go into a lot of detail except to say that it's an area of considerable consternation across the world, particularly as the instrumentation becomes increasingly more complex and it seems that it's more and more difficult to clean it in the first instance or to sterilize it. Flash sterilization in North America, at least we still feel, should be limited to emergency situations only. The use of scrub suits, masks, caps, and boots, very interestingly, has never been the subject of a formal randomized controlled trial. It is part of the etiquette in the operating room. However, some operating rooms have done away with the booties. We have noted that the use of customized caps in the operating rooms is becoming very prevalent. These are cotton caps that have very nice printed designs reflecting the time of year or whatever message you want to carry on your head, and unfortunately these caps get reused without being laundered, and that's something to look out for. Masks and scrub suits are the standard in the operating room, as are gowns and drapes. However, there has been no randomized controlled study to show that these things are necessary, but they are still part of what we do in the surgical environment. Excuse me. In the operating room, asepsis in the operating room, surgical technique, drains are very important. The surgeon's acronym is cut well, sew well, heal well, and that is something that the surgeons hold dear. Hypothermia during surgery has been the subject of at least two prospective studies that show that if the core temperature drops below 36 degrees centigrade, that there is the risk of increased risk of infection. Hypothermia interferes with host defenses, and particularly in open bowel surgery where the abdomen is open, it is important to attempt to warm the patient with warming blankets and perhaps the warmed intravenous fluids as necessary, and to monitor the core temperature. This is an easy maneuver, and it's something that really, I think, has found its place as a new intervention to prevent surgical wound infections. Supplemental oxygen, likewise, is important. It's been shown that carrying on with supplemental oxygen into the postoperative period is extremely valuable in reducing the risk of infection. There are some logistical problems in doing so in the postoperative period because it's quite a change in postoperative anesthetic recovery procedures to give higher flows of oxygen postoperatively. However, there is now good evidence that it is valuable. The natures of dressings hasn't been well studied. However, it is felt that a surgical dressing is applied until the wound is sealed and healed for at least 24 to 48 hours may be beneficial. And obviously, discharge planning is very important. Some of the issues around surgical technique, I will say I am not a surgeon. I'm an internist, a microbiologist. But maintaining effective hemostasis, preventing hypothermia, as talked about, and the gentle handling of tissues are very important. Avoiding inadvertent entries into a hollow viscus, such as entering the bowel, obviously is something to be avoided, but sometimes cannot be avoided. Removing of devitalized tissues is a basic surgical technique, and using drains and suture material appropriately is something that has to be paid attention to. Dead space is not desirable, and careful management of the incision postoperatively is part of postoperative care. On slide 13, I show you the results of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons database from 1999, where they looked at the perioperative complications following coronary artery bypass grafting, what we lovingly known in North America as the CABG procedure. Atrial fibrillation occurs in about 20% of cases, generally short-lived and more a nuisance, although can be hemodynamically significant. But when you look at the other complications of being ventilated for greater than a day, being readmitted for 30 days at 5%, and you add up the surgical or other postoperative infections of surgical infection at 2.6%, pneumonia at 2.5%, and a UTI, meaning a urinary tract infection, at 1.5%, it's clear that an infectious complication is one of the most prevalent complications after coronary artery surgery, and half of those are surgical wound infections, again, highlighting the significance these play in the care of patients undergoing surgery. The U.S.'s National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System has an accumulated database of hundreds of thousands of procedures, I expect, by now, and they have validated the NIST Risk Index that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It is very important, if you're going to entertain surveillance for surgical wound infections, to be using a risk stratification procedure. We have used the NIST Risk Index at our hospital here in Canada, and though we're not a NIST hospital, obviously, because we're not in the U.S., we have found that it correlates very well with the overall outcomes, and I do recommend it as one very well-proven risk index that you can use. It's easy to apply. It's data that should be available. You use the wound class being greater than a clean contaminated or contaminated surgery, meaning a Class 3 or a Class 4 procedure, you get a point. The American Society for Anesthetic score being greater than or equal to 3, you get a point. And if the duration of the surgery is greater than the 75th percentile, as published by the NIST annual updates, which you can get in the American Journal of Infection Control, usually every June or July, you'll get up to 3 points. If you have 0 points, your risk of an infection is quite different than if you have 3 points. And if you look now on slide 15, and this is taken from the NIST report from 1999, We do get these updates every year, and the 2004 was again published in June in the American Journal of Infection Control. However, the theme is still the same, that the cut point is published, so you can use that for calculating the NIST risk index. And if you note, for example, an abdominal hysterectomy in someone who had no risk factors has a risk of, according to NIST, of 1.5%, but if you had several risk factors, the risk goes up to 6%. Likewise, for coronary artery surgery, counting both the sternotomy and the vein donor site, that the infection rate can be as low as 0.7%, but can be as high as 17% in very high-risk cases. And that's highly relevant. If you're going to be reporting rates back to surgeons or to your quality of care committees, you must risk stratify your cases. To do otherwise is really to do a disservice to those you're reporting the rates to. Now, as to surveillance on slide 16, I highly recommend that if you are doing major surgery in your hospital and if you're not doing surveillance for the surgical wound infection rates, that you take a moment to think about that. Surgical wound infections, I've tried to show you, are very important. They have a very large economic impact on a hospital, and surgical wound surveillance is effective in reducing your infection rates. And that is extremely important, particularly if you risk stratify your rates and you use good, sensitive case-finding methods. Ways to find your surgical wound infections? Well, the way we do it at Kingston General Hospital is shoe leather epidemiology. One of our infection control practitioners, Jane Burden, has been doing this work for us for over a decade now. And we get the list from the operating room. We know who's been operated on. We go ahead and review the patient at the bedside as well as review their chart, and use all of that information, plus the information from the laboratory, to decide if they have an infection using the NIFS definitions, which are well standardized. And we have found that if we take that information and make a commitment to reporting our rates of infection back to our surgeons in a confidential manner every month, that we have seen a meaningful and significant reduction in our surgical wound infection rates. My feeling on this is that the surgeon is the most useful quality control monitor of the surgical care of the patient, because they see the patient preoperatively, intraoperatively, and postoperatively. However, we don't stop there. We also report the rates back to the surgical team and to the various other committees related to surgery, so they too can play a very important role in knowing what the surgical infection rates are. Other ways to do case finding is to rely on your operating room information system, and depending on the sophistication of your hospital's information systems, you may be able to do a major chunk of this case finding using an online search protocol in your patient care computer system. Not all hospitals have those kind of sophisticated systems, and chart review with bedside observation would be, in my view, a gold standard, but chart review is still another way to go about it that's pretty good sensitivity. Post-discharge surveillance has been talked about. It's very difficult to monitor and to accomplish. Depends a lot on the style of surgery done in your region, whether your patients come back for the visits or not, or are distributed out through the region never to be seen again. We would love to be able to do post-discharge surveillance, but recognize it's just beyond our means to do so. Performing surveillance in day surgery can point to significant quality issues and could be done on a rotational basis. We do laparoscopic cholecystectomy and carpal tunnel release procedures and laparoscopic hernioraphies periodically and on a rotating basis. It is essential to report the rates back to your surgeons. At the Resources for Infection Control and Hospital study published in the American Journal of Infection Control in August of 2003 out of Canada, we demonstrated that still a significant number of hospitals are not performing surgical wound surveillance, nor are they reporting the rates back to the surgeons. It's impossible to expect much quality improvement without those things being in place. I'll skip over slide number 17. It gives you an outline of the definitions of superficial, deep, and organ space infections, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, based on the CDC criteria. And on slide 18, I do give you at least one reference regarding the values of supplemental oxygen, and I'm just going to leave that for for you to look at on your own, and I've already addressed it. I'll turn your attention to slide 19, antimicrobial prophylaxis. And there are four basic principles taken from the CDC guidelines for preventing surgical infections, with which I agree, that using antimicrobial prophylaxis, or AMP, agent for operations where their use reduced the SSI rates or for operations where an SSI would be catastrophic would be the indication. There are now many good reviews, particularly from the American Society for Healthcare Pharmacy of America, which have outlined the indications for antimicrobial prophylaxis. Certainly surgery that involves a prosthetic device, neurosurgical procedures, cardiac procedures, thoracic vascular procedures, joint replacement procedures, most abdominal hysterectomies, many would argue most cesarean sections, as well as open cholecystectomies and high-risk laparoscopic cholecystectomies would be the kinds of procedures where antimicrobial prophylaxis is indicated. You want to select an agent that's safe, that's cheap, and is bactericidal. Here our choices are often first-generation cephalosporins. Although they may not cover all of the potential pathogens, they cover enough of the pathogens to reduce the microbial load to be highly effective. There are a large number of prospective randomized controlled trials that clearly highlight the best agents. The first-generation cephalosporins clearly are the way to go. And a good resource, if you're looking up this, is to use the medical letter on drugs and therapeutics available around the world, which every other year produces a summary of the literature on this topic. The timing of the initial dose is very interesting. It should be delivered such that it's in the blood and the tissues before the surgeon opens the skin. This sounds simple in principle, but is actually in practice quite trying and difficult to accomplish, and we'll come more to that in a minute. I'd like to also mention that you should maintain therapeutic levels during the procedure, which if the procedure goes on for more than two half-lives of the drug, that you want to give a second dose, usually at the third to fourth hour. The timing is a fascinating issue around the prophylaxis of, as well as the agent that are chosen. First and second generation cephalosporins are most commonly used. I highly recommend first generation cephalosporins for everything except bowel procedures, where a second generation cephalosporin that has anti-anaerobic spectrum, such as cefotetan, to mention only one, would be an option. The drugs should be administered within 2 hours of the onset of the procedure, and a study by Klassen and Burke in the New England Journal of Medicine clearly showed that, taking all comers, that if we got the antibiotics into the patient within that two-hour preoperative window, the risk overall of infection rate was reduced significantly. The timing, however, can be a very tricky issue. The general consensus is that administering antimicrobial prophylaxis should not occur more than 30 minutes before the incision, because you want to have the drug have sufficient time to circulate and to achieve therapeutic levels in the skin. So ideally, at 60 minutes would be the ideal time to give it time to infuse, but up to 30 minutes. The exception there would be cesarean section, where it has traditionally been given after the cord is clamped to prevent the child from getting a dose of antibiotic. However, this is not absolute. There's a recent Cochrane review which has indicated that indeed there is no problem with giving the antibiotics before the incision for a cesarean section, and my obstetricians and pediatricians are not worried about the dose of antibiotics the neonate would be exposed to, and thus we are moving in my hospital to giving the antibiotics before the onset of the cesarean section, not after cord clamping. Vancomycin, I would remind you, must be infused for a full hour. If you infuse it any faster, you'll result in hypotension, which isn't popular with anesthetists. On slide 21, some aspects of the prophylaxis there are summarized, and they, again, to repeat, the choice of agent, the timing, and very importantly, limiting the duration of antimicrobial prophylaxis that's given following the surgery. Really, postoperative doses are passé. They're not necessary. I'd like to just highlight the study by Klassen and Burke in 92, because it is a classic study. They performed a prospective analysis of 2,800 clean and clean contaminated procedures. And if you look on table on slide 23, you'll note that the surgical wound incidence is significantly lower with a relative risk of 0.15 for people who got their antibiotics less than 2 hours preoperatively. And that, and anything outside of that, you weren't very successful in reducing the risk of infection. Take-home message, if you're going to give an antibiotic, you give it within 2 hours. If you're really good at it, you want to give it within an hour, but you want to have it done and in within 30 minutes before they start the incision, ideally, so it's infused and it achieved tissue levels. Harbarth also looked at the impact of prolonged surgical antimicrobial prophylaxis in a prospective study in 2000. They looked at 2,600 coronary artery surgery patients. There were those who received their antibiotics for less than 48 hours postoperative and those who received them greater than 48 hours after surgery. They looked at the incidence of infection and the isolation of resistant organisms. And if you flip now to slide 25, they found that 57% of patients received their antibiotic prophylaxis for less than 48 hours, and 43% tended to receive them longer, about half and half. What they found was that there was no difference in the surgical infection rates, and the odds ratio of a resistant pathogen was slightly increased in the people who had more prolonged exposure. Thus, there is no benefit to giving it postoperatively, and there is a problem with increasing rates of resistance that you need to be aware of. Now, if you think of a line from the funny thing happened on the way to the forum where Pseudolus says, wait, Hero says, yes, Pseudolus, a bright idea. Hero, yes, Pseudolus, that's what we need, a brilliant idea. So if we turn to slide 27, I'm going to tell you about what we thought was a pretty cool idea at our place in terms of a study that we did here at Kingston General Hospital. The picture is the facade of the Watkins wing of Kingston General Hospital. And as an aside, when Canada was constituted as a country, in 1867, Sir Kingston was the capital of Canada. We are no longer the capital of Canada because we were felt to be at risk from invasion from our neighbors to the south at that point in history. And Queen Victoria moved the capital of Canada up to Ottawa. Kingston hasn't forgiven Her Highness for that, I don't think. But at the Watkins Wing, before the Parliament buildings, which are now our City Hall, by the way, were built, Parliament of Canada was held in Watkins Wing at Kingston General Hospital. Kingston General Hospital is a 466 tertiary care center, and we undertook a prospective cohort study of 6 years of duration of surgical patients, amounting to 7,300 patients who were entered into our study. 669, there were data problems, so they were excluded, leaving us with 6,700 surgical cases to be analyzed. As I mentioned, we have Jane Burden, who does an awful lot of surveillance for us, and she receives the operating room list every day. She looks at the chart. She examines the wounds throughout their stay in hospital. We use the CDC definitions. She detailed the onset of the prophylaxis with respect to the drugs, the choice, the timing, and all of the fine details, and recorded this in a computerized database. And all of this was reported back to the surgeons and the infection control committee and so forth. We included coronary artery surgery, valves, lung resection, aortic aneurysm repairs, lower limb vascular procedures, colonic resections, abdominal hysterectomies, and knee and hip total arthroplasties. And we excluded emergencies, children, patients with a contaminated or dirty wound, persons who had been on antibiotics before 24 hours prior to the surgery, or anybody whose data was incomplete. We looked at what we labeled the effective first prophylactic dose, or EFPD, and we said this dose was effective if it was given as the correct drug, the correct dose, the correct route, which is always IV, and the correct timing within 2 hours preoperative, as we discussed. And we used, as I say, the CDC criteria for determining what was and was not an infection. When we look at the hospital variables, we analyzed where the first prophylactic dose was given. Was it given in the operating room or on the ward or in our same-day admit center? As I'm sure you're all aware, same-day admit surgery is now the norm in many surgical disciplines. We looked at the time between the dose was given and the incision, whether it was 2 hours or less or more. We looked at the duration of the procedure, the total duration of post-op surgical prophylactic antibiotic exposure, and we also took into account the year, the class of the wound, whether an order was actually written for the prophylaxis, and ultimately decided, was this effective prophylaxis or not? By that I mean, did they give it the way it was supposed to be given? We looked at the age, the gender, the risk level, the allergic status of the patient with respect to antibiotics, their pre-op stay, their post-op critical care days, their procedure category, and the other IV drugs that they received simultaneously. Now, on slide 32, you'll see the protocol for prophylaxis that is pretty standard in the industry that we followed at that point in time. And we've already talked about those drugs and their alternatives, and I won't go over that now. And that's the same for slide 32. And if you turn to slide 33 now, the analyses, we did a univariate analysis where we looked at the frequencies and the rates. We assessed the distribution and normality and skewness and so forth. We also looked at bivariate and multivariate analysis using stepwise logistic regression model to look at the antibiotic timing and the effectiveness of the antibiotic timing and the surgical outcomes to see if there's a relationship. On slide number 34, you can see that the effective first prophylactic dose success rate over 6 years varies. Now, if you have color, you can see the red, which is colonic surgery. The success rate seemed to dip over time and settle out. You can notice that on the bottom is gynecology, where the success rate was quite low, less than 50% at times. And in cardiac surgery, the dark blue triangles overall had the best success rate, about 90% getting their antibiotic in an effective way, meaning the right drug, the right dose, the right time. This was a concern to us in that we therefore had reason to be worried about the prophylactic delivery issues. Now, I've already mentioned this, but the proportion of our cases that were same-day admit cases approached 90% towards the end of our study. Same-day admit procedures really taking off in 1998-99, and now in 2005, very few people are admitted the day before surgery. When we looked at, on slide 36, the effective components, we see that the biggest issue is the wrong timing. 63% of the cases where the antibiotic prophylaxis was not administered correctly was failed to be administered correctly because of the timing issue. The route was never the problem. They always gave it IV. The dose was always right because you're generally giving either vancomycin 1,000 milligrams or cefazolin 1 or 2,000 milligrams. Drug choice was an issue in about 18%, or in 19%, it wasn't given at all when it was really indicated. So clearly then, from a quality management point of view, looking at the timing was going to net us the most benefit. When we looked at our own risk factors for a surgical site infection, you can see that if the effective first prophylactic dose occurred, your risk of getting a wound infection dropped a relative risk of 0.69, meaning you were 30% less likely to get an infection. If you're looking in the second column, the procedure duration, we used the reference group being orthopedic surgery, that the 1.4 relative risk for procedures that were greater than 100 minutes, and if you drop all the way to the bottom, if your procedure was greater than 200 minutes, you had a 3.5-fold increased risk of surgery, looking down the second column. The NIST risk index did correlate, as I've mentioned before, with the surgical infection risk, and the timing of the first antibiotic likewise did pan out as a risk factor, particularly if it wasn't given at all. That was clearly a problem. And if you turn to slide number 38, the summary of the factors that predict for an effective first dose. If you don't get the first dose, you're more likely to get an infection. Then what are the things that predict for the first dose going wrong? Well, it's interesting to note that the positive correlations, indicated by a plus, seem to be going from left to right in cardiac surgery. If the prophylaxis was given in the operating room, you are more likely to get your prophylaxis in an effective way. If you said, I'm allergic to a beta-lactam, you were less likely to get your antibiotics effectively. And likewise, it was done through the same-day admission unit. That told us that patients saying I'm allergic is a problem, because we know frequently those allergies are not real allergies, but it does tend to foul up your chances of getting your effective antibiotics. So that's something to look at, how the allergy history is taken, and that it's taken with some precision, and that the second-line drug is chosen effectively. Being admitted through the same-day unit for all except joint replacement surgery, likewise, tended to be a negative predictor for getting your effective prophylaxis. And that led us to do a very detailed system review of what's going on in the same-day admit unit as it was a new technology for us. Going over to the left for the surgical prophylaxis being given in the operating room, you can see that that, for all cases except hysterectomy, tended to correlate with the effectiveness of the antibiotic, meaning that the antibiotic was given on time, more often than not, when it was given in the operating room. However, that didn't hold true for everybody. It tended to not be the case for hysterectomy procedures. And likewise, again, if the order was written, that was a positive predictor for getting the effective first prophylactic dose, but not in cardiac surgery. We feel that the reason in cardiac surgery is because the preoperative evaluation and assessment of patients in preoperative care in the cardiac surgery environment is very, very, very choreographed, and therefore writing the order just didn't seem to matter very much. I've already discussed these risk factors on slide 39, and I'll just leave them for you, but turn your attention to slide 40, talking about interventions. Therefore, I think our interventions to improve timing are to improve the awareness. That is, we are now calculating the rates of appropriateness of first prophylactic dose and feeding that back to the surgeons and to the operating room staff. We've done a very detailed an assessment of how we document allergies, and I've now got the intravenous is being started in the same location preoperatively for everybody except cardiac surgery, and that the operating room has the appropriate stock of antibiotics and the second-line choices should the patient be allergic to the first line. And we are still working on the issue of whose responsibility it is to write the order for the prophylaxis. There can be differences of opinion. An anesthetist can say, well, it's really the surgeon's responsibility, but the surgeon is sometimes not in the right place at the right time to assure that it's being given. That continues to require work. So we caution you that our results are applicable to Kingston General Hospital, that we determined patient and process variable that were detrimental and beneficial to getting an effective first prophylactic dose in. Using focal points can devise an intervention, and so we have worked on education materials. Feeding back of this information back to physicians, I think, is the most powerful way to influence behavior, but it is also the most time-consuming. And also the environment of where you're administering the antibiotics needs to be taken into account. The next slide, slide 42, is courtesy of the Canadian Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Program, or CNIF. This is a program that has been running now for over a decade in Canada where infection control units from across the academic sector can meet courtesy of Health Canada and the Public Health Agency of Canada. And they have built a surgical interface database that we are now hoping to be able to use to monitor surgical infection rates across the country. I've been asked to head up this project, and we're hoping to be able to use this database so that we can have common variables. However, we have also, if you turn to slide 43, been able to aggregate Canadian data on cardiac surgical infections, and I'd like to finish up with some of this interesting information before allowing some time for discussion and questions. The acronym there is CHEC, meaning the Canadian Hospital Epidemiology Committee. That's an assembly of approximately 30 infectious disease infection control units across the country, again, sponsored by the federal government and the Public Health Agency of Canada. We have collected data for cardiac surgery from 1999 to 2001. Indeed, there's more data that hasn't been all assembled, so I'm showing you the most recent data file, but there is more data to come. The sites are coded using a code name so that we don't know who everybody is for anonymity's sake. And you can see that different sites have contributed very differing numbers of cardiac procedures, and we now have pediatric hospitals involved as well. We do have some very large centers that do up to 2,000 or 3,000 cardiac cases a year. In the next slide, on slide number 44, you can see the number by age group. The pediatric group tends obviously to be very young, and the adult group peaks out on age in the 60s and 70 age range, which is what you would expect. And we have in our database now the distribution on slide number 45 by age for the infants, And in age of months, the bulk of the pediatric cases happen within the first 2 months of life, which is very commonly the case in pediatric cardiac surgery in the 421 cases that we have accumulated to date. You'll see that men outnumber the females in the adult range, and likewise for the males, as males are slightly more likely to have a congenital cardiac lesion than females. And on slide 47, you can see that by wound class, the vast overwhelming majority are indeed clean procedures, and rarely would they be classified as a clean procedure. And I think anything classified as contaminated or dirty has likely just been misclassified. Cardiac surgery infection by depth, the overall infection rate for this group, taking all comers, was 4.9%, but that is not risk stratified. And some of these are done in the highest risk centers in Canada. The superficial infection rate is 3.3. The deep infection rate is 0.5% with an organ space infection of 4.9. And if we look at on slide 49, the cardiac surgery number of procedures distributed by ASA code, the American Society for Anesthetic Code, which is an index of risk analysis, you can see that there are very few who have mild systemic disease or a normal healthy patient, obviously, and many of them have severe or incapacitating systemic disease to account for their intrinsic risk. So cardiac surgery is a risky business and associated with an infection rate in Canada that approximates 5% overall. And if we look at the impact of ASA score, sure enough, on slide 50, you'll see that if your ASA score is greater than or equal to 3, your risk of an infection approaches 10% as opposed to the baseline. And in slide 51, you can also look at the effect of the duration of the procedure. The average duration is 3 to 4 hours. I think the cut time in the NIS index is about 5, which is about twice as long as many of the cardiac procedures seen here. So the NIS index is fairly forgiving in including duration, but if we wanted to create a Canadian cut time, we might instead of take 5 hours, take 4 hours. And the risk of infection doesn't seem to correlate with the cut time at the five-hour mark in our hands, and so we may want to adjust the cut time, as I say, leftward into 4 hours. The length of stay and the number of procedures and associated with the length of stay, the average length of stay is between 1 and 2 weeks. If we looked at on slide 54 now, if you move ahead, the number of procedures with infection, this is the number of procedures, 6,000 or so in the gray column for adults, and again, 322 had an infection, about 5%. And likewise, it's about a 5% for the pediatric group that had an infection overall. And again, the depth of infections on slide 55 the distribution is slightly more towards superficial infections for adults and more organ space infection for the children, which is a worry, obviously, with a significant outcome. So there is a difference there that we need to take note of. And the last slide, slide 56, funny thing happened on the way to the OR or the forum with Phil Silvers and Zero Mustel. I sure hope that he remembers my antibiotic on the way to the operating room. And I will stop there, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions. Paul?
Dick, thank you very, very much. As always, an outstanding presentation. I think I've heard maybe 100 of your lectures, and they're always very good.
Can you explain what flash sterilization is?
It's probably a Canadianism. It's sterilization in a steam autoclave that's located in the operating room for the drop instrument. It's put in a tray, a fast cycle, and then taken out but not wrapped. We call that flash.
Okay. And I do have another question. It's about your infection prevention and control resources. How many infection control practitioners do you have at Kingston?
At Kingston General Hospital, we've just hired our fourth ICP. So we have about 1 to 110 beds, which is the North American gold standard we're looking towards. So I'm feeling very bullish right now with where we are.
Yeah. Well, that explains why you can do such a lot of surveillance.
Yes, we feel that an investment in surveillance is very, very important. The province of Quebec in Canada has issued a policy statement for that province that they're shooting for 1 in 133 beds. So there they have a provincial policy now that they're working towards.
Excellent, excellent. Very interesting. Thank you very much.
Did you find that a higher body mass index was a pre-op factor for a higher SSI rate?
That's a risk factor? That's a very good point. I think your average surgeon would agree that the higher body mass index is associated with increased risk of infection. That's one of those pieces of information that's really hard to get in your average hospital. We need to do a better job, I think, of weighing people and getting their height and doing that calculation. We're working on that, so we don't have that information. I hope that we can add it on in the near future, however. I expect it is a risk factor.
Thanks.
Just waited, just did a case control that we presented, and it really showed glucose levels related to not the one that's the insulin-dependent diabetic, but the ones who you don't know are diabetic. The kind of silent person was the group that was getting infected. So what we're doing is really monitoring much more accurately glucose levels and doing a lot of work in that area and giving insulin much more aggressively during the surgery. Anyway, just an area to think about in CABGs, and it's made quite a difference.
Yeah, I think that's the next level. That's taking it to, really detailed risk management procedures. And I think as we standardize our preoperative assessment of people for same-day admit surgery, there's an opportunity to build all that in. I think that's terrific.
And just the other thing is we did put on our pre-admission screen that we now get BMIs on everyone. They have a height and weight, and they can calculate it pretty fast.
Yeah, that's now the pre-admission one-stop shopping center where you get your pre-admission work done will allow us to do more sophisticated risk analysis for sure.
Good presentation. I just want to stress the importance. In Kelowna General, we have about 326 beds, and we have two full-time ICPs. We were kind of going by the old Health Canada guidelines by 1 in 175. We'd love to hit your gold standard, 1 in 110, and we're trying to actively recruit about 10 ICPs to get projects like this undergoing. Just out of a question in regards to Jane doing this surveillance, has she been able to do this just as a full-time job in terms of one full-time equivalent doing the surveillance?
Well, I should really let Jane answer that question, but... Jane has a budget for shoes attached to her salary. I'm just kidding. But you can imagine the amount of pound pavement she has to pound. Yes, when we, in 91, we made the commitment. We hired on Jane, and we were able to recruit her here. And this is basically her job in her life, is surgical surveillance. She also does all the problem solving for the operating room, sterilization and disinfection issues, and similar things related to that.
Wow.
So she made a career of being a surgical specialist ICP.
We have an issue in our facility with physicians who continue to use what they call bug juice. What is your assessment and what does the literature show about use of antimicrobial rinses in the surgical procedure?
Yeah, it's. I think it's passé. I think really a topical, neomycin and whatever applied in a rinse or even some cefazolin mixed in and sloshed around the surgical space or in the peritoneum really is antiquated. There's no good evidence that it does any good. It doesn't nearly do as good a job as systemic antibiotics would, and so I think that it really is something that's quite antiquated and you'd like to try and talk people out of. I'm not aware of any harm, however, so that's the difficult part on our side to try and argue against it. But you just have to challenge the surgeon. Show me, level 1A evidence that this does any good.
Hi. I have a question about the warming IV fluid. We have IV fluid warmers, but there was discussion about throwing the IV bags into the warmer and then administering it to the patient that way. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, and I'm a little out of my depth as I don't hang around in the OR and give IV fluids. I'd like to have an anesthetist answer your question. I mean, intrinsically, I think our operating room keeps people warm with warming blankets. Those are the air-filled things with the air pump that pumps the warm air around the patient. That seems to work adequately. I suppose if you had a very long, large laparotomy, they could add warm IV fluids, but I wouldn't imagine that it would matter, but I'm not really an expert in that technology.
And the other question is about administering oxygen, one of your slides said 30 to 80% 2 hours post-op. How common a practice is that?
Well, I tried to bring it on board. Wasn't met with a lot of success because obviously now with anesthetic techniques, people are awake and up and about very quickly post-operatively. Certainly for coronary artery surgery, we can give supplemental oxygen because they're intubated for some hours post-operative. And you have to use higher flows of oxygen, which does require significant change. I don't think our uptake with this has been as good as it could.
When you're looking at surgical site infections, I know you're looking at sites without an implant being infected possibly up to 30 days, but when there's an implant up to 1 year, with the short stays after surgery, how are you able to decide what's happening when the patient goes home? And if an infection is picked up later, how do you conclude that that came from the OR and not from outside factors? Thank you.
Well, I think Kingston is a small community. We're about 200,000 in the environment. So we've got a big medical center and a small community serving compact areas. So I think when Jane goes shopping on Saturday, she kind of checks up on people as she sees them in the shopping mall. That's our approach. What we do now is if you're readmitted to the hospital and you're under our list, we're following you for a year after CABG, you'll flag on our patient care system. Now, maybe you're coming in to get something totally unrelated done, but if you're getting something related done, you're going back to the OR or you've been readmitted, we'll know about it. It's not as formalized as it could be, and as our patient care system becomes more sophisticated, we are putting in procedures to know that if you had a culture, that's coming to Jane. If you get antibiotics administered in hospital, that's going to come to us. We don't have that yet, but that'll be the kind of alerts. So there's a certain amount of ad hocery and word of mouth. Our ID clinicians are very good. If they see a postoperative infection, they tell Jane. And she's up on the surgical floors. So if she sees Mr. Jones' chart up there, she's going to pull it and say, what the heck is he doing back in? It isn't quite as rigorous as it could be, but that's one of the advantages of having somebody so dedicated to it.
Thank you to all who have joined us today, and thanks again to Dr. Dick Zoutman for the time and talent that it took to present this teleclass. Until we meet again, goodbye.